Good afternoon, everyone. I'm calling this meeting of the Taxes Committee to order for February 20th, 2024. First item on our agenda is approval of the February 15th minutes. Vice Chair Norris, do I have a motion?
Yes, Chair Gomez, I move adoption of the minutes from the February 15th meeting of the Tax Committee.
Vice Chair Norris has moved the minutes from February 15th. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, please say no. Motion carries, and the minutes from February 15th, 2024 are adopted. All right, so we're going to move to our first item, which is a House research, a brief overview of the child tax credit that was included in the 2023 tax budget bill. I'll turn it over to Mr. Williams.
Chair Gomez and members, for the record, I'm Sean Williams from House Research. I'm going to briefly describe sort of how the mechanics of the child tax credit that was enacted in last year's tax bill works, how it's calculated, those sorts of things. In your packets, I have a short publication on the child tax credit, and it's a little bit confusing. The numbers in this publication are for tax year 2024, because we sort of tried to publish forward-looking numbers, but the numbers in the presentation are for 23, if you're confused why there's a difference. But under the new law enacted last year, the child and working family credit were still coded separately in statute, but the calculation of the two credits has been combined. They're jointly phased out. One way to think about the new structure is that the old law, working family credit, gave larger amounts for taxpayers with children. And so the new child credit sort of combines the aspects of the old working family credit that gave larger credits to people who had qualifying children. The child credit enacted last year is $1,750 per qualifying child ages 0 to 17. The working family credit still exists. It's equal to the first 4% or 4% of the first $8,750 of earned income for a maximum earned income based credit of $350. The combined amount of those two credits is jointly phased out at $35,000 for married filers filing joint returns and $29,500 for unmarried filers. There's also sort of a working family credit for older children, and that's sort of necessary mechanically to hold harmless the families that don't have children that are 0 to 17, but we're getting higher working family credit amounts under old law. So the credit for older children is $925 for taxpayers with one child, $2,100 for taxpayers with two older children, and $2,500 for taxpayers with three or more older children. And for the older children that qualify for that credit are all 18-year-olds, and then 19 to 20, it's actually 23, this is a mistake in my slide, 23-year-olds who are students or who are permanently and totally disabled. This is a table. I'm not going to walk through it step by step, but it sort of gives you an idea of what the maximum credits would be for different family situations and then the income levels at which the credit is fully phased out for married, joint, and unmarried filers. You can see that the credit scales up based on the number of children, and the phase-out also scales up based on the number of children because you're sort of phasing it down from a higher starting point. This graph just shows the credit amounts. It's the same information in some ways as displayed in the previous table. It just shows you that the credit is larger for families with more children. You can see this sort of slow phase in over the first $8,750 of earned income, and that's the working family piece of the credit that's based on earned income. And then you see the phase out. This is a graph for married joint filers. So you can see the phase down starts at $35,000. And the credit sort of phases down by 12% of earned income above $35,000 for married joint filers. And that's sort of the high-level overview that we're going to give. Happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Williams. Is there – I'm sorry that I didn't ask you ahead of time about this, but I learned a lot about sort of phase-outs and the impact of stacked phase-outs on refundable credits when we were developing this policy last year. And then you even went a step further and got me information about where certain kind of social service kind of supports for families, for sort of lower and moderate income families, phase out as well. And so I didn't ask you to put a slide together, but if you could just talk a little bit about that and what the impact of kind of stacked phase outs of refundable credits is on, you know, families who rely on this source of support, that would be great.
Chair Gomez and members, kind of broadly, a lot of sort of social support programs that you're describing, things like SNAP and TANF and other things, sort of start to phase out in a similar income range as, you know, the old law, working family credit, and then the new law, the child credit. You know, there was some discussion in conference committee last year about sort of if the child credit had sort of been stacked on top of the working family credit, how that could have sort of exacerbated high marginal tax rates in the phase out range. And so, you know, it's still an issue with the current child credit structure that that phase out occurs with other credits. So it probably partially overlaps with the phase out of the federal earned income credit. It partially overlaps with the phase out of the state dependent care credit. And then, as you mentioned, there's kind of, you know, public support programs like SNAP and other social welfare programs, housing assistance, child care benefits, those sorts of things that may be in the same range. And so, you know, as a policy design question, you as policymakers may think it's a concern that, you know, someone in those ranges, you know, has a very high marginal tax rate when you consider that both, you know, tax benefits and then other social service benefits are being phased out over the same range. So, you know, they might earn, you know, $1,000 in extra income and lose, you know, a very high portion of that back in sort of lost benefits. So that's sort of the policy concern there.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. So just want to mention that, you know, that was a, this sort of program design that incorporates that kind of combines the child tax credit with the working family credit, instead of having it be kind of a totally different program that's additive, means that these phase outs are much smoother for families, which means that it's not like, oh, if you get, you know, one extra dollar over this amount, it kind of creates a cliff for people. So I guess I just wanted to say that was an important part of the House position on the child tax credit last year, and you know, Mr. Williams just did a absolutely like astounding amount of work to make sure that the design of the child tax credit was really just focused on the whole picture for a family rather than just like considering it as an isolated you know, benefit that these families who need help would get. So I don't know if there are any other questions or comments, or we can move on to the next part. All right, not seeing any. Thank you very much, Mr. Williams. Okay, so next we have Commissioner Marquardt here again. That wasn't supposed to sound so like, oh, God, here we go again. We are always thrilled to be joined by Commissioner Marquardt, who's going to just talk a little bit about where we're at. He gave us a brief update in his overview of the bill last week, feels like last month, last week about, you know, how many people had claimed the bill. So we just wanted to kind of invite him into this conversation to give us an update. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I'm Paul Marquardt, Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, and it's always good to be back. I really, really do appreciate this. And, you know, we can have all of the great bills passed and signed by the governor, but how it gets out and implemented is really going to be the key if it's going to make a difference that we want. And Mr. Williams explained all the mechanics of the bill and so forth. One thing to mention is that if done correctly, this could lower child poverty by 33%. And, you know, you look at studies, and, you know, quite frankly, in all the years I've been here, I've never seen any single program that we have passed in the law out of this tax committee that I think could have such a transformational, generational impact on the state. And we know if we can lower child poverty, we have better educational outcomes, better, stronger workforce, stronger economies, better health care outcomes, lower health care costs. It really makes a huge difference. So a major goal of Governor Walz, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, is the implementation. And I, again, want to thank the House and the Senate for taking this child tax credit and using what Senators Rest had with the working family credit and the House, meshing those two programs together and for many benefits, like the chair mentioned, a smoother phase out. But also, I think, really focused on the levers that can really reduce child poverty. So just a huge thank you for the great work the House did and the Senate did last year on putting that child tax credit together. So very quickly, I was here last week. I won't repeat much of what I said, but just on the child tax credit outreach, we know that probably 10% of the 300,000 families that could qualify have never filed taxes before. You need to file to get the credit. And so the outreach has been significant, working with the governor's office, working with many advocates around the state, over 170 free tax preparation sites, 33 grantees that were given money just to go out and advertise these credits. We have met individually with the Department of Health, Department of Human Services. So like if they're doing Medicaid or SNAP or some of these other programs that come in contact with families, they have the information to be able to connect with those families that they are currently working with. So we're looking at also working with service providers that provide services to tribal nation members to get into those communities. So we're really looking at working together with various groups who are in these spaces with children and through other programs that already exist through the Department of Health and Human Services, for example. So we're really doing those type of things. So a status report on where we're at. I gave you one a couple days ago. We now have new numbers. If I have them, here we are. So it's up to $178 million now have gone out on the child tax credit. And about $43 million on the working family credit. We're able to divide those up. And then that is 139,000 qualifying children as of this point. So, again, we're looking at about 300,000 families, and so there's a lot more work to be done. And this outreach effort is going to continue throughout right to the end, April 15th. So that's the implementation is really going to be big. And like the other day I asked if whatever you can do in getting that information out to your constituents would be really, really good. And the one final thing, again, is for next year, we're looking at advanced periodic payments, working with advocates who have really been involved not only in developing the original child tax credit, but in working to now work on the advanced periodic tax credit. We're looking at a lot of different things that we'll have more to present as we go further, but we're now looking at meeting with larger groups of stakeholders as we look at an advanced periodic payment plan for that. So, Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Any questions for the Commissioner while we have him?
Sure.
Representative Weiner.
You referenced child poverty. Can you define and what are the metrics for child poverty?
So thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Weiner. So we're using the supplemental poverty level. And I might be able to get some more help on exactly what that number is. But Minnesota is around 8 to 9%, which actually is we rank actually pretty low in child poverty compared to other states. But, for example, when the federal, in 2021, when there's the advanced payment, it lowered that supplemental poverty rate from about 9.5% to about 5.2%, is about a 46% cut. But what that income level is, I have to get back to you on that. I don't know if it's on the federal poverty level, a certain percent, or what exactly that measure is. I'd have to get back to you on that.
Representative Weiner?
Networks.
Great. Thank you. So definitely we'll follow up, and I'm sure that our staff can get some information to you about what constitutes poverty for different size families, because obviously that's a big contributing factor. So, and Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Marquardt, I just had a quick clarifying question. You mentioned a percentage of filers who had never filed before that would qualify, and I just wanted to see if you could repeat that.
Oh, yes.
Commissioner Marquardt.
Chair, Representative Lee, we think about 10% of the 300,000, so about 30,000 of those families that we think would qualify have probably not filed taxes in the past.
Representative Lee?
Thank you.
Great. And so those families are like people who don't have tax liability because they make kind of usually a very low income, and also because both the Minnesota Working Family Credit, which is based on the federal earned income tax credit, requires earning a minimum kind of a minimum level of like income in order to qualify for those refundable credits. So there are these, and they're usually really low income families who just don't end up having to file taxes. And so, that's kind of, to me, one of the really important designs of the way that we chose to do the child tax credit was just that there isn't a minimum income level. And so some of those families who are really struggling the most, but who don't qualify for refundable federal or state income tax credits do qualify for this refundable tax credit. As long as I'm talking about my favorite design features, I wanted to just say that most of these refundable credits, it's like, I think it's three kids. It's like if you have 10 kids, for example, you get the same amount as somebody with three kids. And so we know every kid adds a really significant cost to your household. And so one of the important things that we did here, which is different than a lot of other kind of similar programs, is that we, if you have six kids, you get $1,750 a head, depending on your income level. So that was actually when we adjusted that, when we uncapped the number of children that you could claim, that was an area that really had a big impact. Yes. On that child poverty level. Because, larger families are just more likely to live in poverty because kids cost lots of money. So just wanted to mention that. Not that any of us know anything about that. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and sorry to have been coming in late. I just want to respond to Representative Wiener's point. I know we'll get more data from staff later, but what I've seen anyway is two adults and two kids, the federal poverty limit is just under $30,000 a year. Total. So you imagine a family of four living on $30,000 a year. If they're on $31,000, they are not in poverty according to our federal guidelines. So that's it's a quite low limit. Anyway, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Any other questions? Thank you so much, Commissioner Marquardt, for joining us and for your continued work on this.
You bet. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank
Absolutely. You, Madam Chair. Appreciate it. All right. Next up, we have a few members of the public who are going to testify and who have sort of expertise in this area. First up, Natlitha Sumo Kali. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record as you get started with your testimony.
All right. Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Gomez and members of the committee. My name is Natlitha Sumo Kali. I'm the Economic Justice Outreach Manager at the Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota. In my role, I work with community partners statewide to help families access tax credits and other work support programs through our Bridge to Benefits and Economic Stability Indicator tools so that they can achieve economic stability for themselves and their families. As a recipient of an outreach grant funded last session, I want to thank you all. With that support, we have been able to add the Minnesota Child Tax Credit to our Bridge to Benefits and Economic Stability Indicator tools. We've also been able to work with partners to help families in every corner of the state to better understand their CTC eligibility and make sound financial budgeting decisions for their family. Through our connections with families in focus groups and surveys, we hear about how this policy will help families achieve their goals and invest in a better future for themselves and their children. One family in White Bear Lake, in one of our focus groups, described the CTC as a breathing room in her tight monthly budget. Another family described the CTC as a cushion. I know we were just talking about the phase out and families working to manage working to live on wages and public benefits at the same time. She mentioned the CTC as being an extra cushion as her family comes up against emergency expenses. We've also done a couple of scenarios in our economic stability indicator tool to get a better understanding of the impact that the Minnesota CTC has on families' bottom line. And with every, we've looked at married families and single households as well. And in every scenario, the trends are the same. The CTC helped families move beyond this precarious paycheck to paycheck existence where one unforeseen expense can destabilize the whole family. And as you all know, that leads to, it negatively impacts the lifetime trajectory of the children. In our analysis on our economic stability indicator tool, we also see that the impact, the positive impact that CTC has is greater on for families with smaller children. As you all know, families with smaller children have expenses as far as like childcare expenses. So this extra funding coming into the household, it goes a long way to kind of go towards some of those expenses as well. So we see that the impact is greater for families with smaller children, especially as they're working to, again, manage wages and then programs and tax credits to meet their needs. So we want to thank you for making this investment, critical investment in children in the state of Minnesota. We believe, we at CDF believe that when all of our children do better, our state does better. So we want to thank you so much for the opportunity to be able to speak with you all today, and thank you for your investment. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony and sharing the experiences of people that you work with who are directly impacted by our work. We don't always get to hear those voices, so we appreciate it. And thanks for all your work working for kids in our state.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate it. Next up is Nan Madden. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Madden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project, which is a program of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits that identifies and advances policy changes to make Minnesota a place where everyone can thrive, regardless of who they are or where they live. You're hearing from other testifiers about the real difference that the child tax credit can make for Minnesota families. And I'm going to speak about the role of nonprofit organizations in implementation, especially in education and outreach to potentially eligible families. We know that the child tax credit is a proven strategy to reduce child poverty and improve family economic security. And a well-designed child tax credit like ours can be especially effective in reducing hardship among children living in rural areas, in communities of color, and in larger families. But reaching that full promise of the child tax credit comes down to implementation, ensuring that eligible families learn about the credit and apply for it by filing their income taxes. And as you heard, that means we need to reach Minnesotans who don't regularly file income taxes because they're not required to do so, as well as reaching those who face financial and language barriers to filing. We think Minnesota's nonprofits have an important role to play in that as trusted community voices. So after the 2023 tax bill passed, we started working in collaboration with our partners so that nonprofit organizations have the information and resources to educate and support eligible families. We did that through making sure that nonprofits learned about the opportunity to apply for the outreach and education grants that were funded by the 2023 tax bill, and especially those nonprofits with strong connections to impacted communities. And we also found ways for nonprofits to provide feedback to the Department of Revenue as they have put together a really strong outreach program and a set of educational materials. At the Budget Project, we're also leveraging philanthropic dollars to further expand the reach of the public investment. We're educating the more than 2,000 nonprofit members of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits about the transformational impact that the child tax credit can have in the communities they serve all across the state. And we've created a centralized online source of information that nonprofits can use in educating their communities about the child tax credit and how to file for it. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share the role that the nonprofit community is playing in this important policy for ensuring that every child can participate in this state's opportunity and prosperity.
Thank you so much, Ms. Madden. Appreciate it. Yeah, we, you know, our Department of Revenue does a lot of outreach and connecting with community themselves, but we really do rely on our partners who have more of this day-to-day connection with people. So we appreciate all of the work that's that a lot of people across the state have been doing on this. Next up, we have Amy Fisher. Welcome to the committee.
Good Good afternoon. My name is Amy Fisher. I've been a volunteer tax preparer at Prepare and Prosper, the largest free tax organization in Minnesota, for the past 3 years. I'm also a mother to 4 sons, ages 9 to 19, and have been primarily a stay-at-home parent since my oldest was born. Unlike many of the volunteers in our organization, I've never been a CPA. I'm just someone who thinks doing her own taxes is fun. The thorough training I received from Prepare and Prosper.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Okay. I've never met anybody like that.
You volunteered for the committee yourself. So.
No heckling the witnesses, please.
I Prepare and Prosper does a thorough training for its volunteers so that, along with a review process, allows me to help about 30 families with their taxes each year. I've long appreciated Minnesota's education tax deduction, and I carefully track my 9-year-old's spring-based rental fees and my 13-year-old's cello lessons, along with all of those last-minute August Target run receipts for school supplies. But most of our clients with kids don't have those records. Either they couldn't afford to pay for monthly trumpet rentals, or saving receipts was one task too many during the chaos of the new school year. The new child tax credit is there for parents without any extra effort on their own parts or regret for actions they could have taken. We all know kids are expensive, and it's only possible to cut costs so far when income is limited. My 3 kids still at home needed 4 pairs of shoes last week, and that ran us for $200 at a discount store with coupons. When my oldest comes home from college, our food disappears faster than we can buy it. For families eligible for the credit, every dollar counts. One single mom told me last week that it's getting harder and harder to stretch her child support, and her work hours are limited to her kids' school hours. She was surprised and so grateful for her larger Minnesota refund this year. $1,750 can pay for 6 weeks of school-age summer care, allowing parents more job possibilities. It'll put wiggle room into so many families' budgets and give them more choices. I volunteer with Prepare and Prosper because of the relief and gratitude of each of our customers when I tell them that their taxes will be done before they leave, and for most of them, that means a refund will be directly deposited in a few weeks. We take the stress and unknown out of the process for them, and I always leave my shift smiling. Thank you for making this possible.
Thank you so much, Ms. Fisher, for the work that you do, even if we're all very confused how anybody would want to file taxes, but we're glad that people like you exist out there. And just, you know, plug for everybody about VitaSites. They're around the state, and they help income-qualified folks file their taxes at no cost and rely on volunteers like Ms. Fisher to make everything go around. So if you know any CPAs who aren't busy January through April, send them over, which is a joke, but it is difficult, you know, for VitaSites to find volunteers, and they're always kind of looking for more people. So we thank you for that. All right. So that concludes our overview of the child tax credit. I don't see anybody who has questions or comments. So maybe we'll revert back to our the piece that we didn't get to last week, which is the House research overview of the 2023 tax bill. We'll invite our team up to get us going on that. And there should be copies of the slides in everybody's packets still.
Chair Gomez and members, Sean Williams from House Research. I want to start by mentioning that we've included in your packets our act summary for the tax bill. So if you're interested in more detail or information about provisions or provisions we haven't covered in the presentation, this might be a good place to start. We're also happy to answer questions to the best of our abilities. So the presentation is going to cover articles that are sort of within the jurisdiction of this committee. So income taxes, conformity, sales and use taxes, local special taxes, public finance, the stadium payoff, the poll tabs article, and the miscellaneous article. We're not touching on every single provision in the bill. We've sort of been asked to hit the highlights, some of the larger and more significant ones in terms of revenue. But if you have questions about other provisions, please let us know. I'm going to cover part of Article 1 relating to income taxes. There's a few changes relating to individual credits. The first is a change to the child and working family credit. I'm going to skip over that because we've discussed it at length today. Another one is the K-12 credit. So the measure of income used for that credit was changed to adjusted gross income from the broader household income measure. The phase out for that credit was increased to $70,000 and indexed for inflation. And the maximum credit was increased from $1,000 to $1,500. In the dependent care credit, there's a relatively small change, but taxpayers are allowed to claim a newborn credit if they have a child within the tax year, even if they don't pay for dependent care for that child. The bill last year allowed unmarried filers to claim that newborn credit. There was the rebate credit that was discussed at length last session, but it was $520 for married joint filers, $260 for unmarried filers, and $260 per dependent for up to three dependents. It was limited to married taxpayers filing jointly with less than $150,000 of adjusted gross income, $75,000 for other filers in tax year 2021. In addition, as we talked about in committee last year, the renter's credit was converted to a refundable income tax credit, and the income measure used for the renter's credit was also shifted away from a broader household income measure to adjusted gross income. That change was essentially delayed 1 year. So taxpayers this year will claim the renter's credit in August, and then next year for tax year 2024, in calendar year 2025, they will file the renter's credit on their income taxes. So the following August 2025, there will be no standalone renter's credit program. There's also a number of changes to the definitions of income in the tax bill for individuals. The first is the Social Security subtraction. That subtraction that was enacted allows a subtraction for 100% of federally taxable benefits for taxpayers with less than $100,000 of adjusted gross income if they're a married joint, and $78,000 of adjusted gross income if they're single or head of household. There's a subtraction for sort of basic pensions, which is sort of what we call in Minnesota pensions that were earned based on service that did not count towards credit for Social Security. The basic pension subtraction is allowed for up to $25,000 for married joint filers and half that amount for unmarried filers. And the phase outs start at the same place as for the Social Security subtraction that I described above. There was a new student loan subtraction enacted last year that was sort of an expansion of the student loan subtraction for discharged student loans that was enacted in 2017. The bill last year adopted permanently the rules that are in the American Rescue Plan Act that were sort of a broader exemption for student loan forgiveness. The ARPA exemption, we've conformed to that and adopted it, but it expires after tax year 2025. The bill established a sexual harassment damages subtraction, so that was just a subtraction from income for damage awards resulting from sexual harassment and abuse claims. And the bill also modified the standard deduction and itemized deduction phased out. Essentially, standard deductions and itemized deductions are now phased out in three tiers. It's a faster phase out that was allowed under old law. So the old law phase out was 3% of adjusted gross income above $220,650 in tax year 2023. That amount is indexed. But the bill added an additional 10% phase out rate above $304,970. And then an immediate 80% reduction in itemized deductions or the standard deduction for taxpayers with more than $1 million of adjusted gross income. The bill also enacted a net investment income tax. This was a 1% tax on net investment income above $1 million in the taxable year. The definition of net investment income comes from federal law. It's defined as interest, dividends, capital gains, rental and royalty income, non-qualified annuities, business income from the trading of financial instruments or commodities, and certain passive business income. And there's a federal 3.8% tax on that same tax base. The state net investment income tax is effective tax year 2024, so that'd be for returns filed next year. The bill also increased the political contribution refund amounts. So I believe this is they were increased to $75 for individuals and $150 for married taxpayers filing joint returns. That covers the individual changes. My colleague, Mr. Klayman, is going to finish on the corporate franchise tax and the other provisions in the bill.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Chris Klayman with the House Research Department. Moving on to the corporate franchise tax changes and some of the other changes to business taxes. I think the three main changes to the corporate franchise tax last year was that the state eliminated the state subtraction for global intangible low taxed income and subjected a portion of that to tax now in the state. At the same time, the what's called the dividend received deduction was reduced from 80% to 50%, and then for corporations that are less than 20% owned, those are the lower figures. That affects the GILTI provision as well, because a GILTI was also specifically treated as a dividend in the tax bill last session. And then the net operating loss limits were changed from 80% to 70% for the, under the state's corporate net operating loss provisions. There were some changes to the business tax credits last year in the tax bill. The first one to mention is the beginning farmer credit. For that one, the credit rate and the maximum credit were increased, and the sunsets were also extended for that. The angel investment credit was funded again or allocated again for $5 million in each of taxable years 2023 and 2024. That's also known as the small business investment credit. The film credit allocation was increased from just under $5 million to just under $25 million. The sunset date for the film credit was also extended. And the sunset for the historic structure credit was also extended. The highlights on the pass-through entity tax changes, this isn't everything that happened, this is just the larger provisions. Tiered partnerships were allowed to elect the pass-through entity tax. These would be partnerships that have, or LLCs or S-Corps that have another partnership or pass-through entity as a partner. And then 100% of a resident's pass-through income was allowed to be allocated to the state for purposes of determining how much pass-through entity tax was going to be imposed on the pass-through entity. And the effect of these two provisions together, and especially the last one, is that a greater amount of tax would be imposed, and then a greater amount of the state and local tax deduction would be allowed federally. And then the corresponding pass-through entity tax credit would also increase to match the amount of tax imposed. There were two new credits in the business tax area that the legislature established last year in the tax bill. First was a credit for the sellers of manufactured home parks to manufactured home park cooperatives. And there was also a short line railroad modernization credit that was enacted to provide a tax credit for certain infrastructure expenses undertaken by railroads. Madam Chair, members, that's the end of the highlights we had for Article 1, and I can just roll through to Article 2 or...
Okay. Yeah, I don't know if anybody has any questions. just want to remind members that all jokes should come through the chair. I missed something. I'm bummed when I miss out.
Would you please recognize Representative?
Next time you got to share with the class. We'll go back to Mr. Clayman. Thank you.
Moving on to Article 2, this was the federal conformity article. So there was a federal conformity bill that passed within the first few days of the legislative session last year. And then there were some further changes Congress made to retirement provisions. This was the Secure 2.0 Act, and the tax bill last year included those additional retirement provisions. Most of the provisions in the Secure Act did not affect federal adjusted gross income, which is the starting point for Minnesota tax, but a few of them did, and they're listed here. Essentially these, I won't read them off, but essentially the provisions that it was in, that the state, that the legislature conformed to are those provisions that have an impact on federal adjusted gross income. So for example, if federal law allows, you know, an exclusion for certain retirement withdrawals, or they establish a three-year time period for repaying those withdrawals, and there's tax consequences of that, that the state then through Article 2 would pick those up. So, but that was Article 2. That was the federal conformity article.
I think Representative Davids, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Clayman, I believe the federal conformity we did last year set a world record on its timeliness. Or do I still hold the record? Can you please explain and be quite sensitive to me?
Mr. Clayman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the federal conformity bill that was enacted last year, it happened pretty quickly. Actually, I think Ms. Templin might actually, if I could pass the buck.
Ms. Templin, the same caveat, please be very careful of Representative Davids' feelings. Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, the 2023 early conformity bill, I do believe, was one of the earliest one in the bills enacted since 2011. since 2011. So I do believe that the bill last session did surpass the the federal conformity bill that was enacted. But I will double check and follow up with it.
Madam Chair,
yes, Representative
Ms. Templin, if you could check, because I'm having nightmares. I think the new chair at the time beat me by a day. We could take that offline.
Ms. Templin, if you could just please
don't get destroyed further.
That's right. If we could just distribute that information to the entire committee, so it's not just going. No, all right. Back to Mr. Clayman, or I don't know if you're dealing with the next section or where.
Yep. So, Madam Chair and members, my colleague Alex Hagler, who staffs sales and use tax and local option taxes, is not here today, so I'm going to fill in for her. So I'm going to cover the rest of the overview here. Again, we're just covering the highlights. As Mr. Williams said, we have included our act summary in your packet, so if you want more detail on other provisions that were enacted, that's a good place to start. So there were three new sales tax exemptions that were enacted in the tax bill last year, one for firearm storage units, one for certain natural gas fees, and then certain amenities included with admission. There were five expanded exemptions in the bill. The suite license and collegiate event season tickets had related to bundled transactions, and provided that existing exemptions would be still subject to exemption if they're part of a bundled transaction. There was a provision for county fairs, nonprofit blood centers. There was one for single member LLCs to provide parallel treatment with multiple member LLCs. There were also, in Article 5, there were 21 separate local government construction sales tax exemptions that were enacted, 9 for cities, 11 for school districts. And then there was a MSP airport construction sales tax exemption for the project at the airport. Article 10 was the local sales and use tax article. There were a number of sections in this particular article, but the highlights are on the slide. There were extensions, modifications, and authorizations for new local sales taxes. There was a local sales tax advisory tax force that was established. And I believe, and here there's a note that the report was submitted in early February with their recommendations. Article 10 also, with respect to local sales and use taxes, established a moratorium on new authorizations for local sales taxes until June 1st, 2025. Article 11 was the special taxes article. These would be not local option sales taxes or local sales taxes, but other local taxes that fall outside the provisions for the local sales tax section of law. Here, the tourism tax in Duluth was extended, food and beverage and lodging tax. And then the Cook County lodging tax was, the sunset on that tax is extended from 15 to 30 years. Article 12 was the public finance article. I won't go through any of this, but you know, typically every year the tax bill includes a public finance article. That's usually the product of an agreement among a number of local public finance officials and bond council. But you can read that if you want. I can provide more detail if anyone would like. But
I don't imagine that will be necessary, Mr. Klayman, but thank you for the offer.
Madam Chair, I can always do section by section if you want to go through again.
It's a page turner.
Article 13 was the stadium article, and this also included a number of provisions relating to charitable gambling. There were some tax rate reductions for charitable gambling, the charitable gambling tax. Audit requirements were modified, and there was a cap on distributor fees for e-poll tabs. This section also imposed the regulatory changes on poll tab devices. This is the open all feature. This article also included provisions relating to paying off the stadium bonds for U.S. Bank Stadium, and allowed those bonds to be prepaid using amounts in the stadium reserve account combined with a smaller portion from the general fund. That stadium reserve account was then repealed. The other provision related to the stadium in Article 13 also reduced the amount of local sales tax from the city of Minneapolis that is required to be remitted to the state to pay for the state share of stadium expenses. Article 15, this is the last article that we're going to highlight today. This is the miscellaneous article. There was a 10% minimum fee for delinquent property taxes that was removed, and the counties were allowed to set a rate below the prime rate. The Office of Management and Budget was required to establish the taxpayer receipt program, which I believe that taxpayer receipt program is actually live on a website. I think you can go to it now. It's published. There was also a provision relating to revenue recapture for nonprofit hospitals, a free filing study that was required by the required for the Department of Revenue. And then lastly, there were a number of grants to local governments, Crane Lake Water and Sanitary District. There was a provision for the Roof Depot site in Minneapolis, Northfield, Spring Grove, and Wyndham. So, Madam Chair and members, that concludes the overview of the tax bill from last year that we had prepared, and I think we could answer questions, too, if members have, would like.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Klayman and Mr. Williams, for that presentation. Are there any questions or comments? All right, not seeing any. Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody, for being here today. Our next hearing of the Tax Committee will be Thursday, February 22nd, where we'll be discussing the renter's tax credit implementation. And with that, we are adjourned.